elected President of the United States. It was a mutually auspicious moment. Mr. Wu and Mr. Kushner, who is married to Mr. Trump's daughter Ivanka and is one of his closest advisors, were nearing agreement on a joint venture in Manhattan, the redevelopment of 666 Fifth Avenue, the fading crown jewel of the Kushner family real estate empire. Anbang, which has close ties to the Chinese state, has seen its aggressive efforts to buy up hotels in the United States slowed amid concerns raised by Obama administration officials who review foreign investments for national security risk. Now, according to two people with knowledge of the get-together, Mr. Wu toasted Mr. Trump and declared his desire to meet the president-elect, whose ascension, he was sure, would be good for global business. Kushner never got his Chinese loan. Anbang retreated rather than face the glare of American publicity. But Chinese money did continue to flow to the Kushner family. Even as Jared Kushner emerged as the most influential advisor to the President of the United States, his relatives marketed condominiums in China with the promise that an investor visa came attached. Emily Rauhala and William Wan of the Washington Post attended just such a marketing meeting in Beijing in May 2017. The arrival of American reporters upset the organizers, who roughly tried to eject them from the hall, explaining, "This is not the story we want." But it's the story that happened. Over several hours of slideshows and presentations, representatives from the Kushner family business urged Chinese citizens gathered at a Ritz-Carlton hotel to consider investing hundreds of thousands of dollars in a New Jersey luxury apartment complex that would help them secure what's known as an investor visa. The potential investors were advised to invest sooner rather than later, in case visa rules change under the Trump administration. "Invest early and you will invest under the old rules," one speaker said. The tagline on a brochure for the event? "Invest $500,000 and immigrate to the United States." And the highlight of the afternoon was Nicole Kushner-Meyer, a principal for the company who was introduced in promotional materials as Jared's sister. Russian banks also acquired a keen new enthusiasm for Kushner family projects. Over the course of the 2016 presidential campaign, Kushner had a number of conversations with Sergei Kislyak, the Russian ambassador to the United States. Two would be disclosed on Kushner's application for a security clearance. The rest would not until press reports compelled Kushner to correct the record after the fact. Kushner would also meet with the head of a Russian state-owned bank implicated in past espionage against the United States. Ned Parker and Jonathan Landy reported for Reuters on the FBI's suspicions about these meetings. FBI investigators are examining whether Russians suggested to Kushner or other Trump aides that relaxing economic sanctions would allow Russian banks to offer financing to people with ties to Trump, said the current U.S. law enforcement official. The bank said in a statement in March that it had met with Kushner along with other representatives of U.S. banks and business as part of preparing a new corporate strategy. A very great many corporations, foreign and domestic, were preparing the same new strategy. Through the transition period, President-elect Trump and his family used their new position to recognize old business associates and seek new ones. On November 14, 2016, Trump spoke for 15 minutes to the president of Argentina, Mauricio Macri. According to reports in the Argentine media, Trump mentioned that a Trump-licensed building in Buenos Aires was stalled in the permitting process. The next day, Trump's local partners triumphantly announced that the building was moving forward. It would later emerge that not only had Trump's daughter Ivanka joined the call, but that Trump's son Eric had arranged it at the request of Trump's lead partner in the Buenos Aires deal. Trump had licensed his name to five projects in India. His partners in those projects stopped by Trump Tower on November 17, 2016. They discussed business with Trump's three adult children, posed for a photo with the president-elect, and gave an interview afterward to an Indian publication, The Economic Times. That's how Americans learned of the meeting. As with the Argentine discussions, the Trump transition team had provided no notice or readout of the meeting to any American media. On November 18, 2016, President-elect Trump would meet with Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe at Trump Tower. Photographs of the encounter between the two leaders showed Trump's daughter Ivanka in attendance. Jared Kushner joined the group as well. At the time of the meeting, Ivanka Trump was in negotiations to license her clothing brand to a big Japanese retailer. That retailer was owned by a Japanese bank, which was in turn wholly owned by the Japanese government. The deal would ultimately fail. Trump tangled government, family, and business in the style of an authoritarian third-world kleptocrat. When a staffer at the National Security Council, NSC, wrote a memo denouncing H.R. McMaster, Trump's national security advisor, as one of the cultural Marxist globalists waging Maoist insurgency against the Trump administration, the document was brought to the president's attention by his son, Donald Jr., the new CEO of the Trump Organization, and therefore someone supposedly walled off from the internal workings of the national security agencies. Authoritarian governments around the world scented possibility in an incoming Trump administration whose style so resembled theirs. Days before the 2016 election, the brutal president of the Philippines, Rodrigo Duterte, named the developer of Manila's Trump-branded property as his special envoy to the United States. Duterte would collect his reward in the form of a flattering phone call from President Trump on April 29, 2017. Trump, I just wanted to congratulate you because I'm hearing of the unbelievable job on the drug problem. Many countries have the problem, we have the problem, but what a great job you are doing. I just wanted to call and tell you that. Duterte, thank you, Mr. President. This is the scourge of my nation now, and I have to do something to preserve the Filipino nation. Trump, I understand that, and fully understand that, and I think we had a previous president who did not understand that. In February 2017, the Trump Organization announced plans for Scion, a new lower-cost hotel line in the United States. Its first franchise in Dallas would be developed in partnership with a company with deep connections in Russia, Turkey, and Kazakhstan. The New York Times reported in May that the developer has been quoted in the Dallas Business Journal saying that the deal would be financed by his family and business associates in Turkey and Kazakhstan. In recent statements to the Dallas Morning News, he backed away from those claims and said the money would come only from him and two American partners. He declined to elaborate to the Times. The government of China approved 38 Trump trademarks in the single month of March 2017. By the end of May, China had granted the president a total of 77, plus a spate more for his daughter Ivanka. The Trump Organization had applied for these marks only a year earlier. Erica Kinetz of the Associated Press reported from Shanghai, Dan Plain, a director at Simone IP Services, a Hong Kong intellectual property consultancy, said he had never seen so many applications approved so expeditiously. For all these marks to sail through so quickly and cleanly, with no similar marks, no identical marks, no issues with specifications, boy, it's weird, he said. Plain said he would be very, very surprised if officials from the ruling Communist Party were not monitoring Trump's intellectual property interests. This is just way over your average trademark examiner's pay grade, he said. Until the financial crisis of 2008, Donald Trump had almost no business interests outside the United States. That year's crisis shattered what remained of his real estate development activity. By the fall of 2008, Trump's casino operation had staggered to its final terminal bankruptcy. Trump Mortgage had collapsed. Trump licensed towers in Florida and Georgia were failing. Trump companies defaulted on $334 million of debt repayment due Deutsche Bank on his last big personally directed project, Trump Tower, Chicago. But Trump remained a TV star thanks to NBC's Apprentice. His name had become a global symbol of ostentatious gimcrack luxe, a brand that once sought to dominate New York City, settled for being big in Baku. The message went forth from Pinsk to Penang, and everywhere dirty money is gained and hidden. If you are looking for someone to shine you up, you can find him in Trump Tower. A four-bylined story for Reuters in March 2017 reported, at least 63 individuals with Russian passports or addresses have bought at least $98.4 million worth of property in seven Trump-branded luxury towers in southern Florida. In the year after Donald Trump secured the Republican presidential nomination, 70% of Trump's customers made their purchases through identity-shielding corporations. Trump sold $33 million worth of real estate in this concealed way in the 6 months after the 2016 election. Trump and his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, claimed to have put in place ethical safeguards against conflicts of interest. These safeguards proved utterly derisory when not wholly fictitious. David Enrich reported in the Wall Street Journal in July 2017 that at a White House tech summit organized by Jared Kushner, the only startup with a seat at the table was OpenGov.com, partly owned by Jared's brother Josh. Kushner promised to divest himself from his family's holdings. But who on earth would buy Jared Kushner's stake in the 666 Fifth Avenue project? What divestment meant in this case was accepting an IOU for his share from other relatives, an IOU that would acquire net value only if someone could be persuaded to rescue the Kushner family as a whole, Jared included. Trump's claims to have divested his businesses proved equally empty. Trump's sons acknowledged that they regularly reported to him on the family company's revenues and operations. Even after the supposed separation within the Trump family, the two sons often attended White House functions and Republican strategy sessions. They acted as White House surrogates on TV and in social media, and posted photographs of themselves from within the White House precincts. Tangling the lines even more tightly, Eric Trump's wife, Lara, would take a job in May 2017 with a vendor to Trump's 2020 re-election effort. She also hosted Trump campaign Facebook video spots. Trump promised to donate all foreign profits earned by the Trump Organization to charity, but as of mid-year 2017, his company has made no effort even to identify such profits, much less disgorge them. Federal conflict of interest statutes exempt the president and vice president from many of their strictures, partly for separation of powers reasons, partly for pragmatic reasons. A president's scope of authority is so vast, there is almost nothing he or she could do that could not affect his or her own economic interests in some way. Even so basic a decision as proposing a budget deficit or surplus could affect the relative values of stocks versus bonds. But these exemptions do not constitute a blank ethical check for the president. Since modern conflict of interest rules took form in the 1970s, presidents have volunteered near-total financial disclosure, including the publication of their tax returns. All the world can see what they have, what they earn, and what they owe, and can judge accordingly whether the president has behaved ethically or not. Trump and Kushner, and indeed even some in his cabinet, have disregarded and defied the post-Watergate norm. Trump has told one untenable story after another about why he cannot publish his returns, finally abandoning the pretense altogether post-election, saying, "The only one that cares about my tax returns are the reporters." Trump's aide Kellyanne Conway scolded journalists who continued to ask. "We litigated this all through the election. People didn't care." The disclosures required of the president by law do not convey much because they apply only to Trump personally, not to the upstream corporate entities through which Trump receives his income and owes his debts. For example, the Trump family is a part owner of a building on the Avenue of the Americas in Manhattan that carries a $950 million mortgage to the Bank of China. That upstream debt weighs on Trump's income, but it need not be disclosed on a federal form. In August 2016, a New York Times investigation suggested that Trump owed at least $650 million, twice as much as his campaign disclosure forms acknowledged. Trump's biographer, Timothy L. O'Brien of Bloomberg View, estimated to NPR early in 2017 that Trump owes in excess of $1 billion to about 150 different financial institutions, vastly more than the $310 million indicated on the first disclosure he filed as president. Trump's son-in-law and daughter also omitted enormous holdings and liabilities from their financial disclosure forms. Their art collection, important investments, and exposure to as much as $1 billion in personal and corporate debt. Trump has successfully rolled back and then some the ethical rules that have accreted around the presidency since Watergate. Tax disclosure refused for the first time since Gerald Ford. Conflict of interest rules ignored for the first time since Richard Nixon. Running a business corporation while in office for the first time since Lyndon Johnson. The first appointment of a relative to a senior government position since John F. Kennedy named his brother Robert Attorney General. The first appointment of a presidential son or daughter to a senior White House position since Franklin Roosevelt's son, James. The first use of presidential patronage to enrich the president's family since Ulysses S. Grant. The first acceptance of substantial foreign cash flows by the president in American history. The first subordination of U.S. foreign policy to the president's business interests in American history. The most lavish spending on the person of a president in American history. Beyond all the many and grave evils of corruption at the top of government is the near impossibility of confining corruption within one office. Early in July 2017, the chief corporate oversight official in the Department of Justice posted a comment on her LinkedIn page explaining her recent resignation. "Trying to hold companies to standards that our current administration is not living up to was creating a cognitive dissonance that I could not overcome. To sit across the table from companies and question how committed they were to ethics and compliance felt not only hypocritical, but very much like shuffling the deck chairs on the Titanic. Even as I engaged in those questioning and evaluations, on my mind were the numerous lawsuits pending against the President of the United States for everything from violations of the Constitution to conflict of interest, the ongoing investigations of potentially treasonous conducts, and the investigators and prosecutors fired for their pursuits of principles and facts. Those are conducts I would not tolerate seeing in a company, yet I worked under an administration that engaged in exactly those conducts. I wanted no more part in it." But while resignations in disgust are one possible response to Trumpocracy, so too is the attitude, if you can't beat 'em, join 'em. Trump is one by one disabling the federal government's inhibitions against corruption. On March 10, 2017, Trump fired the 46 U.S. attorneys who had not resigned when the administration turned over. Congress has established 93 U.S. attorney positions in total. This was more or less normal practice for a new administration. What happened next was not. Trump left the U.S. attorneys' jobs vacant for months. A legal expert explained the consequences to the New York Daily News. "While the U.S. attorneys' offices will move forward without heads in place with uncontroversial cases, like ordinary fraud and white-collar crimes, there are a whole bunch of crimes that, under DOJ procedures, require approval coordination between DOJ headquarters and actual Senate-confirmed U.S. attorneys. Public corruption and international terrorism need to be coordinated with Maine Justice. If you don't get people in these roles where they're supposed to be working with prosecutors on the ground, it could really slow down high-profile criminal investigations. Trump did at last begin to send names forward for U.S. attorney posts in July 2017. As he did so, it became obvious why the search for replacements had taken so long. Trump was seeking personal loyalists. Trump, normally indifferent to mid-level personnel, actually met in person with a candidate for U.S. attorney for the District of Columbia, the U.S. attorney with potential criminal jurisdiction over his staff and himself. In the words of CNN's Laura Jarrett, such a meeting, some former Justice Department and White House sources say, sharply departs from past practice and more generally is at odds with the understood custom of insulating U.S. attorneys from political influence. Donald Trump never accepted the concept that the law should be insulated from politics. He repeatedly publicly demanded that his attorney general initiate criminal proceedings against his former opponent, Hillary Clinton. His 11-day communications director, Anthony the Mooch Scaramucci, bizarrely tweeted a demand on July 27, 2017, that the FBI investigate the leak of his financial disclosure forms. Scaramucci hastily deleted the tweet after it was pointed out to him that A, the forms were public documents, and B, it is a serious crime for a White House staffer to attempt to order the FBI to investigate anyone. Where would the Mooch get the notion that a White House staffer could initiate such an investigation? From his boss, of course, who insisted in a July 2017 interview with Peter Baker, Maggie Haberman, and Michael Schmidt of the New York Times that the director of the FBI should report personally to the president. And when Nixon came along, inaudible, was pretty brutal, and out of courtesy, the FBI started reporting to the Department of Justice. But there was nothing official, there was nothing from Congress, there was nothing anything. But the FBI person really reports directly to the President of the United States, which is interesting, you know, which is interesting. And I think we're going to have a great new FBI director. Power creates temptations, and that is true even for the smallest increments of power. The power of the building inspector, of the customs official, of the cop at the traffic stop. It took a lot of work by a lot of people over a long time to build even America's highly imperfect standards of public integrity. Undoing that work would be a far easier task. Corruption is the resting state of public affairs. Integrity, a painstaking, unceasing struggle against cultural inertia and political gravity. Nepotism fits naturally within authoritarian governments, poorly within republics and democracies. Shortly after entering the presidency for the first time, George Washington laid down a definitive rule against it. I would not be in the remotest degree influenced in making nominations by motives arising from the ties of amity or blood. Trump assigned his dubiously competent son-in-law a chair at the Principals Committee of the National Security Council, the innermost ring of American power. Among Kushner's duties, reorganizing the federal government, winning the war against ISIS, and negotiating Israeli-Palestinian peace. Kushner also took it upon himself to attempt to create a clandestine back channel to the Russian leadership, using the facilities of the Russian embassy to elude detection by U.S. security services. On President Trump's visit to Israel in May 2017, the president brought Jared Kushner into his meeting with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, leaving his national security adviser, H.R. McMaster, waiting outside the door of his suite in the King David Hotel, according to the gossipy but usually reliable Cafe Knesset, an account uncontradicted by the Trump White House. It was on Kushner's advice, too, that Trump abruptly reversed his position on legal status for young illegal aliens without prior notice to either the Attorney General or the White House Chief of Staff. At the G20 summit in Hamburg, Trump invited his daughter Ivanka to fill his chair when he exited the room. The theory of American government is that official role, not blood relationship, determines who does what. If the president dies in office, he is succeeded by the vice president, not the first lady. There is no such role as first daughter, despite Ivanka Trump's sometime use of that title. Yet at Hamburg, Ivanka posed with her father in group photographs with the Chancellor of Germany, the Prime Minister of Canada, and other leaders, none of them joined by spouses or children. On the first day of his new administration, President Trump sought and got from his Justice Department an interpretation of the 1967 anti-nepotism law that allowed him to bring his daughter and son-in-law aboard. It held that the 1967 law applied only to members of executive agencies and that the White House staff did not count as such. The DOJ's opinion acknowledged that this permission represented a new interpretation of the law, but it argued that under the circumstances, innovation was warranted. Was it not better to bring informal advisors into the government where they would be subject to conflict of interest rules and other federal ethics laws? The Deputy Assistant Attorney General who wrote that opinion soon proved sadly naive in his expectations. The Kushners accepted the prestige, power, and perks of the White House, but not its ethical obligations. It was just as Thomas Jefferson had warned after leaving the presidency, a bookend to Washington's strictures against nepotism 2 decades earlier. Towards acquiring the confidence of the people, the very first measure is to satisfy them of the president's disinterestedness, and that he is directing their affairs with a single eye toward their good, and not to build up fortunes for himself and family, and especially that the officers appointed to transact their business are appointed because they are the fittest men, not because they are his relations. The satisfying assurance that the president is appointing the fittest individuals and not seeking to build up fortunes for himself and his family is precisely what is most lacking under Trumpocracy. Chapter 5. Betrayals. Trump's former press secretary, Sean Spicer, took his Catholicism seriously. So when the attendance list for President Trump's May 2017 meeting with Pope Francis was released, reporters were startled to see Spicer's name missing. First Lady Melania Trump would attend, as would Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump. The Secretary of State would join, as would the National Security Advisor. Then the list took a detour down the protocol hierarchy. Trump's communications advisor, Hope Hicks, made the list. So did his bodyguard and factotum Keith Schiller. So did Dan Scavino, Trump's social media manager, famous for retweeting alt-right memes, sometimes with a sharp anti-Semitic edge. No Spicer. Even the White House press corps, its members frequent targets of Spicer's rages and victims of his manifold untruths, felt a pang of sympathy for their tormentor. That planners of this trip couldn't or wouldn't get at Sean Spicer into the Vatican speaks to a small-mindedness I find incredibly depressing, tweeted the New York Times' Glenn Thrush. His colleague Maggie Haberman agreed. This seems needlessly harsh. When else is Spicer likely to meet the Pope, and it mattered to him? Anyone who follows President Trump's Twitter feed has perceived Trump's unstable temperament, his self-pity, his tantrums, his blame-shifting. The reporters who cover him struggle to convey the ritual humiliations he inflicts, the rancor he incites. "He's the meanest man I've ever met," a reporter who traveled on the Trump campaign remarked to me in the spring of 2017. Trump has created a snake pit working environment, seething with hatreds and perforated by mutually vindictive leaks. He extracts groveling flattery in public and private, but never requites even the most abject loyalty. To work for Donald Trump, you must ready yourself to lie and lie. Remember Trump's doctor, Harold Bornstein? In August 2016, Bornstein put his signature to a medical assessment that Donald Trump's health was astonishingly excellent. The assessment concluded, "If elected, Mr. Trump, I can state unequivocally, will be the healthiest individual ever elected to the presidency. In fact, Donald Trump would become the oldest man to enter the presidency, and most likely the third most obese after William Howard Taft and Grover Cleveland. Those who work for and with Trump must accept that he reserves the right to embarrass or denigrate them at any moment for any reason, or for no reason at all, just impulsive whim. Here's one of dozens of examples chosen because it involved the aide Trump has praised more volubly and publicly than any other, Kellyanne Conway. "There is no den she will not go into. When my men are petrified to go on a certain network, I say, 'Kellyanne, will you go?' And she gets on and she just destroys them. So anyway, thank you, baby, thank you, thank you. Be careful." Trump thrust upon this lavishly praised aide the duty to appear on CNN on the day of the firing of FBI Director James Comey to deny the obvious. She said, "This has nothing to do with Russia. Somebody must be getting $50 every time Russia is said on TV. This has everything to do with whether the current FBI director has the president's confidence and can faithfully execute his duties." 2 days later, of course, President Trump would himself appear on NBC with Lester Holt and acknowledge that the firing was driven by his exasperation at Comey's refusal to exonerate him of the Russia thing. "And in fact, when I decided to just do it, I said, you know, this Russia thing with Trump and Russia is a made-up story. It's an excuse by the Democrats for having lost an election that they should have won." Conway and the rest of the Trump talkers were abandoned to make the best they could of that, as of so many things. In one mad Twitter moment, Trump actually formally alerted the whole country not to rely on those who spoke for him. "As a very active president with lots of things happening, it is not possible for my surrogates to stand at podium with perfect accuracy." Trump's vice president, Mike Pence, has been obliged to deliver untruth after untruth on Donald Trump's behalf. On January 15, 2017, Pence confronted a carefully phrased question from CBS's John Dickerson on Face the Nation. Dickerson asked, "Did any advisor or anybody in the Trump campaign have any contact with the Russians who were trying to meddle in the election?" Pence replied, "Of course not. And I think to suggest that is to give credence to some of these bizarre rumors that have swirled around the candidacy and the fact that a few news organizations, not this one, actually trafficked in a memo that was produced as opposition research and associated that with intelligence efforts, I think could only be attributed to media bias. And I said this week at the press conference, the American people are tired of it." At the time Pence spoke, the flagrant falseness of those words was known to President Trump himself, to the president's son, to the president's son-in-law, to the president's former campaign manager, and, it seems likely, to the president's newly designated chief of staff. Yet nobody set the poor vice president straight. And the highly forgiving vice president seems not to have objected at all to being left in the dark in this way. During the Russia inquiry, the country got to know Trump's so-called legal advisor, Jay Sekulow. Sekulow ran a pair of non-profit Christian advocacy groups, from which he directed some tens of millions of dollars to himself, his family, and their businesses. Between 2011 and 2015, Sekulow collected $230 million in charitable donations, The Washington Post reported in June 2017. Through a complex arrangement involving the two charities, $5.5 million was paid directly to Sekulow and five family members in salary or other compensation, tax records covering those years show. Another $7.5 million went to businesses owned by Sekulow and his sister-in-law for producing and consulting on TV, movie, and radio shows, including his weekday program, Jay Sekulow Live. And $21 million went to a small law firm co-owned by Sekulow, records show. These arrangements were approved by a board of directors entirely made up of Sekulow's family members, all of them paid via the charities. It's more like a family business than a public charity, said Daniel Borachoff, president of the American Institute of Philanthropy, which runs Charity Watch. You would have to have a lot of trust in this family in order to want to give them your money. The most troubling of all of Trump's hires, however, was his principal national security advisor during the campaign, the former Lieutenant General Michael Flynn. Books could and will be written about the tragic arc of the heroic battlefield commander who dwindled into shabby dishonor, and perhaps much worse, after failing at the capstone job of his to-then-impressive career, director of the Defense Intelligence Agency. Flynn turned to extremist anti-Muslim ideologues, accepted money from Russian and Turkish clients, failed to disclose as the law required, and made himself the face of some of the Trump campaign's mob outbursts. In normal presidential campaigns, the national security team keeps well away from the more contentious forms of politicking. Condoleezza Rice, for example, spoke at the 2000 Republican convention, but she had not one single negative word to offer about any living person. The closest she approached to invective was this: "The first Republican that I knew was my father, John Rice, and he is still the Republican that I admire most. My father joined our party because the Democrats in Jim Crow, Alabama of 1952 would not register him to vote. The Republicans did." Here, by contrast, is Michael Flynn. He took the stage at the Cleveland convention to wild chants of "lock her up, lock her up." Flynn repeated the chant, as he had so often done while campaigning for Trump. "That's right. Lock her up. That's right. Lock her up. I'm going to tell you what. It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. Yes, I use hashtag never Hillary. That's what I use. I have called on Hillary Clinton. I have called on Hillary Clinton to drop out of the race because she put our nation's security at extremely high risk with her careless use of a private email server." The crowd resumed chanting, "lock her up," and Flynn repeated the phrase. "Lock her up. Lock her up. You guys are good. Damn right. Exactly right. There's nothing wrong with that." More chanting of "lock her up." And you know why? And you know why? You know why we're saying that? We're saying that because if I, a guy who knows this business, if I did a tenth of what she did, I would be in jail today. So crooked Hillary Clinton, leave this race now. 2 months after that "if I did a tenth" comment, Michael Flynn reportedly joined a conversation with top Turkish ministers to discuss the kidnapping and forcible removal to Turkey of a U.S. permanent resident sought by the Ankara government for political offenses. Flynn attended the notorious Trump Tower meeting in June 2017, at which Donald Trump Jr. was offered Russian state materials incriminating of Hillary Clinton. As a former DIA director, Flynn had to understand what Donald Jr. would later claim he did not appreciate, that he was witnessing and being invited to participate in a Russian espionage attempt against the U.S. political process. Flynn would later neglect to disclose his Russia contacts on the relevant forms, forms signed under the penalty of felony. Enabling the bad people in the Trump orbit were the weak people. As White House counsel and White House chief of staff, Trump appointed two of the least experienced, least commanding holders of either job in recent history. Counsel Don McGahn learned 2 weeks before Inauguration Day that Flynn was being investigated by the FBI. He did not or could not stop Flynn's appointment. Chief of Staff Reince Priebus allowed Trump's favorites to build self-aggrandizing empires of a kind never before seen in the West Wing. Jared Kushner has, and Trump's former political adviser Steve Bannon had, his own full-time press aide. Ivanka Trump and Kellyanne Conway each has her own chief of staff. Bannon even acquired a perk otherwise awarded only to the president and vice president, his own personal body man, to follow him wherever he went. Sarah Huckabee Sanders answered a reporter querying the unprecedented entourages of Bannon, Kushner, Conway, and Ivanka Trump as follows. It's a great thing that staffers are so engaged at such a high level and have created very ambitious portfolios within the president's agenda. We are shaking things up, and it's a great thing for which the results will ultimately speak for themselves. Empire building by subordinates is made possible by Trump's disengagement from management, policy, and lawmaking. In late June 2017, President Trump convened Republican senators in hopes of rallying support for the leadership's version of Obamacare repeal. According to an account of the meeting published in the New York Times, a senator who supports the bill left the meeting at the White House with a sense that the president did not have a grasp of some basic elements of the Senate plan, and seemed especially confused when a moderate Republican complained that opponents of the bill would cast it as a massive tax break for the wealthy, according to an aide who received a detailed readout of the exchange. Mr. Trump said he planned to tackle tax reform later, ignoring the repeal's tax implications, the staff member added. Trump had one big idea to gain passage of the health care bill: the intimidation of holdouts, like Nevada Senator Dean Heller. Heller ranked as the most vulnerable of the Republican senators facing re-election in 2018. He shied from supporting the very unpopular Republican bill. Trump threatened to run seven figures worth of attack ads against Heller if he did not yield. McConnell complained to Reince Priebus that attacking Heller would be beyond stupid. As reported by Glenn Thrush and Jonathan Martin in the New York Times, "They didn't check in with anybody," said Josh Holmes, Mr. McConnell's former chief of staff. "There was no clearing of channels, no heads up, nothing." In this instance, Trump relented. But Trump would return to attack other members of his party who vexed him. He fixed all the blame for the failure of Obamacare repeal on Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. He waged Twitter battles with Arizona's two U.S. senators, John McCain and Jeff Flake, as well as with Tennessee's Bob Corker, after each criticized him, never quite grasping that their support was at least as essential to him as his was to them. Over the course of 2017, the Trump White House one by one extruded its wild men and gradually assumed something more like orderliness under Chief of Staff John Kelly and National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster. But even as the courtiers evolved toward higher professionalism, their king's madness raged hotter and fiercer. I close the editing of this book on the weekend that President Trump responded to a post-hurricane humanitarian catastrophe on the U.S. territory of Puerto Rico by plunging into hours of Twitter abuse of the mayor of San Juan for not being nice to him. The mayor of San Juan, who was very complimentary only a few days ago, has now been told by the Democrats that you must be nasty to Trump. Such poor leadership ability by the mayor of San Juan and others in Puerto Rico who are not able to get their workers to help. They want everything to be done for them when it should be a community effort. 10,000 federal workers now on island doing fantastic job. We have done a great job with the almost impossible situation in Puerto Rico. Outside the fake news and politically motivated ingrates, people are now starting to realize the amazing work that has been done by FEMA and our great military. Trump would not take advice. He would not behave presidentially, insisting rather that his behavior was perfect, just as it was. "My use of social media is not presidential. It's modern-day presidential. Make America great again." After he nearly lost his top economic advisor by seeming to condone Nazis and white supremacists on the rampage in Charlottesville, Virginia, Trump doubled down at a rally in Phoenix, Arizona. "Dishonest people. So here is me. I hope they're showing how many people are in this room, but they won't. They don't even do that. The only time they show the crowds is when there's a disruptor or an anarchist in the room. I call them anarchists, because believe me, we have plenty of anarchists. They don't want to talk about the anarchists. If you're reading a story about somebody you don't know, you assume it's honest because it's like the failing New York Times, which is, like, so bad. It's so bad. Booing. Or the Washington Post, which I call a lobbying tool for Amazon. Okay? That's a lobbying tool for Amazon. Or CNN, which is so bad and so pathetic, and their ratings are going down. Booing. Right? Proud. CNN sucks. CNN sucks. CNN sucks. But all the networks, I mean, CNN is really bad, but ABC this morning, I don't watch it much, but I'm watching in the morning, and they have little George Stephanopoulos talking to Nikki Haley, right? Little George. And he talks about the speech I made last night, which, believe it or not, got great reviews, right? But they also said that he must be a racist because he never mentioned the driver of the car, who is a terrible person, drove the car and he killed Heather, and it's a terrible thing. But they said I didn't mention, so these are my words. The driver of the car is a murderer, and what he did was a horrible, inexcusable thing. They said I didn't mention it. And then they asked me, just to finish it, they asked me, what about race relations in the United States? Now, I have to say, they were pretty bad under Barack Obama, that I can tell you. Heather is a reference to Heather Heyer, the young woman who was run over and murdered by a white nationalist at the August 2017 demonstration in Charlottesville. This was Trump's only mention of her in his entire Phoenix rally speech, which took place 10 days after her death. As in his previous business career, President Trump reacted explosively to any attempt to subject him to anything like normal political or even human limits. White House officials and informal advisors say the triggers for his temper are if he thinks someone is lying to him, if he's caught by surprise, if someone criticizes him, or if someone stops him from trying to do something or seeks to control him. Thus, Nancy Cook and Josh Dawsey reported for Politico in August 2017. They were reporting after the Charlottesville fiasco, a political crisis aggravated by Trump's refusal ever to acknowledge error or change course. In some ways, Trump would rather have people calling him racist than say he backed down the minute he was wrong, one advisor to the White House said on Wednesday about Charlottesville. It's for that reason that Trump filled his White House and administration with the deferential, even servile. He appointed his former personal bodyguard Keith Schiller to direct Oval Office operations. On the campaign trail, Schiller and his team gained an ugly reputation for violence against lawful protesters. In maybe the most dramatic instance, Schiller snatched a protester's banner, then smacked the protester in the face after he tried to seize it back. It was Schiller who would deliver to James Comey the notice of his termination as FBI director. Donald Trump entrusted his online presence to a former golf caddy, Dan Scavino. It was Scavino who oversaw the retweeting from accounts like @WhiteGenocideTM, located in Jewmerica, and the scavenging of message boards for images like that of Hillary Clinton's face atop a pile of money and alongside a Star of David bannered Most Corrupt Candidate Ever. The Star of David was later amended to a circle. Trump hired a former manager at the Trump Hotel in Washington, D.C. as chief usher of the White House. He named Omarosa Manigault, a former contestant on The Apprentice, to the White House staff. He appointed the former wedding planner of his son Eric Trump to oversee federal housing programs in New York City, a post in which loyalty matters even more than usual to Trump, since his company collects millions of dollars of revenue every year from that program. Interestingly, that program was the only program to be exempted from the draconian cuts to housing spending in Trump's first budget request. Trump hates criticism and expects huge, heaping servings of flattery. The flattery mostly occurs behind closed doors. On June 12, 2017, however, the country was given a televised view when Trump invited cameras to record the opening moments of a cabinet meeting. Vice President Pence set the tone. "The greatest privilege of my life is to serve as vice president to the president who's keeping his word to the American people." By that point, Trump had already broken his campaign promise to build a wall and have Mexico pay for it. 2 weeks later, the Carrier furnace plant in Pence's home state of Indiana, supposedly saved by Trump's efforts, would close and all its manufacturing jobs would move to Mexico. Chief of Staff Reince Priebus continued, "On behalf of the entire senior staff around you, Mr. President, we thank you for the opportunity and the blessing that you've given us to serve your agenda." One by one, like members of the Soviet Politburo addressing Comrade Stalin, they paid their more or less fulsome tributes. "I am privileged to be here, deeply honored, and I want to thank you for your commitment to the American workers," said the Secretary of Labor. "It was a great honor traveling with you around the country for the last year, and an even greater honor to be here serving on your cabinet," gushed the Secretary of the Treasury. "Mr. President, what an incredible honor it is to lead the Department of Health and Human Services at this pivotal time under your leadership. I can't thank you enough for the privileges you've given me and the leadership that you've shown," said the head of that department. A normal cabinet would balk at such self-abasement. A normal president would gag at it. President George W. Bush, for whom I worked, especially distrusted flattery and flatterers. His eyes would narrow and a cynical smile would form as if to say, "Now I see what you are." Donald Trump expects and rewards it. Such behavior is profoundly shameful, and honorable people will not do it. This fact forces a president who wishes to do it to hire dishonorable people and to thrust honorable people into irretrievably dishonorable situations. No American military man of his generation commanded more universal admiration than did Lieutenant General H.R. McMaster. A combat veteran of Iraq, Afghanistan, and the Gulf War, and also the author of an acclaimed book about civilian-military relations, McMaster embodied the high ideal of the soldier intellectual, a man who excelled in both thought and action. When President Trump named McMaster to replace the Russia-compromised Michael Flynn as National Security Advisor, the wise people of National Security breathed their relief. "An outstanding choice," exulted Senator John McCain. In the spring of 2017, this fine public servant faced a serious challenge. He had consented to serve a president elevated to power in some considerable part by clandestine help from Russia, an unfriendly power. The exact degree of collusion between the Trump team and Russia remained shadowy at that time. President Trump had not yet fired FBI Director James Comey, and Donald Trump Jr.'s "I love it" email welcoming Russian help would not come into public view until July 2017. Yet the odor of treason already hung heavy in April. The Allies worried about Trump's incessant praise of Vladimir Putin and about his campaign statements raising doubts about America's NATO obligations, statements seconded by important campaign surrogates like Newt Gingrich, the former Speaker of the House. America's allies wanted reassurance, and McMaster believed he had found the perfect way to deliver it. At the newly built headquarters of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization in Brussels, a monument had been erected to the spirit of Article 5, the treaty's mutual defense guarantee. A NATO summit was scheduled for May 25, 2017. There, Trump would personally dedicate the Article 5 monument and reaffirm America's pledge to defend its allies. The appropriate words were written, circulated, revised, and approved in a process overseen by McMaster personally. The day before the speech, a senior administration official, most likely McMaster himself, briefed the New York Times that Trump's NATO speech would explicitly endorse Article 5. President Trump is expected to publicly endorse NATO's mutual defense commitment at a ceremony on Thursday at the alliance's headquarters, an administration official said, breaking months of silence about whether the United States would automatically come to the aid of an ally under attack. Mr. Trump will make the promise in Brussels at the start of 3 days of meetings with European heads of state, according to the official. The agreed language remained in place as late as the morning the speech was to be delivered, according to Susan Glasser of Politico. Then, at the last second, Trump balked. He stood in front of the monument. He read the speech. He omitted the pro-Article 5 language. Why? Ideology? Russian influence? Truculent resistance to the advice of others unless swaddled in extravagant flattery? Who knows? Whatever the reason for the language's disappearance, it fell to McMaster to undo the damage. Standing before the traveling press corps in Taormina, Sicily, on May 27, 2017, 2 days after the NATO speech, McMaster expostulated that nothing untoward had happened. On the record, this time he said, "I think it's extraordinary that there would be an expectation that the president would have to say explicitly that he supports Article 5. Of course he does. He did not make a decision not to say it. It was implicit in the speech. There was no decision to not put it in there. It is a matter of fact that the United States, the president, stands firmly behind our Article 5 commitments under NATO." One of the most honorable soldiers of his generation felt obliged to speak untruths to protect the United States' global interests from the consequences of the president's willfulness. When good men do bad things, they usually have good motives. McMaster, like many other national security experts and veterans, joined the Trump administration in the hope of protecting the country. Perhaps there was ambition mixed in, or some other lesser motive. We are all human. But they could fairly assure themselves that they dealt with the devil for the noblest of reasons. In the months after Trump's surprise Electoral College victory, many conscientious people wrestled with the question, should I take a job in the Trump administration? A week after the election, Elliot Cohen, an anti-Trump Republican who had served at senior levels in past administrations, eloquently advised those facing this dilemma to answer yes. It seems to me that if they are sure that they would say yes out of a sense of duty rather than mere careerism, if they are realistic in understanding that in this enterprise they will be the horse, not the jockey, if they accept that they will enter an administration likely to be torn by infighting and bureaucratic skullduggery, they should say yes. Yes, with two conditions, however, that they keep a signed but undated letter of resignation in their desk office, as I did when I was in government, and that they not recant a word of what they have said thus far. Public service means making accommodations, but everyone needs to understand that there is a point where crossing a line, even an arbitrary line, means, as Sir Thomas More says in A Man for All Seasons, letting go without hope of ever finding yourself again. It goes without saying that friends in military, diplomatic, or intelligence service, the career people who keep our country strong and safe, should continue to do their jobs. If anything, having professionals serve who remember that their oath is to support and defend the Constitution and not to truckle to an individual or his clique will be more important than ever. Scarcely a week later, Cohen changed his mind. My about-face began with a discreet request to me from a friend in Trump world to provide names, unsullied by having signed the two anti-Trump foreign policy letters, of those who might be willing to serve. My friend and I had agreed to disagree a while back about my taking an uncompromising anti-Trump stand. Now he wanted assistance, and I willingly complied. After an exchange about a senior figure who would not submit a resume but would listen if contacted, an email exchange ensued that I found astonishing. My friend was seething with anger directed at those of us who had opposed Donald Trump, even those who stood ready to help steer good people to an administration that understandably wanted nothing to do with the likes of me, someone who had been out front in opposing Trump since the beginning. The problem, as Cohen now perceived it, was less Trump himself than the mini-Trumps with whom Trump surrounded himself. One bad boss can be endured. A gaggle of them will poison all decision-making. They will turn on each other. No band of brothers this. Rather, the permanent campaign as waged by triumphalist rabble-rousers and demagogues, abetted by people out of their depth and unfit for the jobs they will hold, gripped by grievance, resentment, and lurking insecurity. Their mistakes, because there will be mistakes, will be exceptional. Nemesis pursues and punishes all administrations, but this one will get a double dose, until it can acquire some measure